President Trump's longtime friend Roger Stone is back in court today, trying to convince the judge who sentenced him last week to 40 months in prison that he deserves a new trial. You'll remember the sentence originally recommended by prosecutors was 7 to 9 years. President Trump tweeted out his displeasure. Attorney General William Barr intervened to ask for a lower sentence. Now, Barr denied it was under pressure from the president, but then went on to complain about Twitter pressure from the president. After Barr's intervention, more than 2,000 former Department of Justice officials called on him to resign for flouting, they said, the principles in their own justice manual that the Department of Justice must be impartial and insulated from political influence. Which got us wondering, just why was the Department of Justice created, and when? We know at the country's birth there was a lot of corruption. One role of the department was to ensure lawyers across the country had the same standard. But for more, let's bring in Robert Kazurowski. He's law professor at Fordham University Law School. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
And we understand that it was the Judiciary Act of 1789, country well underway, that established what was called a federal justice system. It had a Supreme Court and a post for the Attorney General, but no department. So tell us more about these beginnings.
It's not until 1870 that the legal business of the United States is centered in the Department of Justice, which is created in 1870. In part to centralize the Attorney General's efforts to enforce the Reconstruction Amendments, which really changes the constitutional structure of the United States by delegating to Congress the power to enforce what we think of as fundamental rights of citizens.
You mentioned Reconstruction. This was post-Civil War, and there was a thinking that
That's right. Yeah,
a lot of people in positions of power were not sympathetic to the idea of Reconstruction and civil rights for former slaves. And so the Department of Justice, this is one theory, was created to help deal with, you know, a lot of litigation that was going to come at the end of the Civil War.
That's right. The primary business of the Department of Justice when it's created is enforcing the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts that Congress enacted to implement those Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And that effort is short-lived because, as you say, there were a lot of people opposed to this. And by the 1880s, the federal government is not doing much in enforcing those rights. And it's not until the 1960s that the Department of Justice in the Kennedy and then the Lyndon Johnson administrations put the power of the Department of Justice behind the enforcement of the civil rights and voting rights of African Americans.
So this was a heroic time for the DOJ, but what were the questions?
Yes.
I mean, here's the president's brother as the Department of Justice. What
That's
happened
right.
because of that?
Bobby Kennedy is an advisor of John Kennedy, and it's Bobby Kennedy who is the primary motivator in the Kennedy administration's support for civil rights. And it's Bobby Kennedy who sends Nicholas Katzenbach, the deputy attorney general, down to Alabama to force the desegregation of the University of Alabama in 1962 or 63. So there's a very close connection between the Department of Justice, headed by Bobby Kennedy, and John Kennedy. That changes when Kennedy's assassinated and Lyndon Johnson becomes president. Bobby Kennedy and his successor, Nicholas Katzenbach, disliked LBJ, and LBJ disliked them. And so they operated more independently of the president than did Bobby Kennedy.
Yeah, and even people who thought that what Bobby Kennedy was doing was good work in enforcing civil rights, there were nepotism laws passed after that, weren't there?
That's right, yes.
Yeah. Well, now bring us up to another relationship. President Nixon and Attorney General John Mitchell, who helped direct the DOJ resources to fight Nixon's political enemies. He fought personal battles on behalf of the president. Nixon resigned before he could be impeached. Mitchell served jail time. Some are holding this up as demonstrating that there are limits to what can be tolerated between a president and an attorney general. Can you look at that through today's prism? When we have President Trump saying he has the right to tell the DOJ to do whatever he wants.
That's right. As a result of that incident, a number of statutes were enacted by Congress to separate the Attorney General's independence from the control of the president. And one of the important reforms that Congress enacted in 1978 was the Ethics in Government Act, which created the Independent Counsel, establishing an officer outside of the Department of Justice to investigate wrongdoing within the administration. Now, there is a connection between what Mitchell was doing and what Barr is doing today. The misuse of government agencies to investigate political opponents and so forth in the Nixon administration is very similar to what Barr is doing with the Department of Justice today, in that Barr is using the power of the Department of Justice to benefit the political interests of the president. The difference, however, between what Mitchell was doing and what Barr is doing is that Barr is interfering directly in cases involving friends of the president, as well as preventing evidence from being presented to Congress that reveal President Trump's wrongdoing. What Barr is doing is truly an abuse of power. It's unethical, and it violates the norms that were established in the post-Watergate era.
Well, but you know, William Barr is a proponent of what's called the unitary executive. This is an executive branch entirely under the president's control. And the president says he's the chief law enforcement officer, that the DOJ is under the executive branch. And therefore, this unitary executive theory applies.
So the unitary executive theory is a theory that evolved in the 1980s with conservative Republicans and the Federalist Society. The critical point in the unitary executive theory that's most problematic is the idea that the president may do whatever the president wants. John Yoo, as a member of the Office of Legal Counsel in the Bush 43 administration, was one of the primary drafters of the torture memorandum, if you recall that. Mm-hmm. And he asserted that unitary executive theory in arguing that the president has the authority to order enhanced interrogation and is able to exercise his powers without oversight of the courts or the Congress. In terms of the case law, the Supreme Court, all the way back to Nixon in United States versus Nixon, where President Nixon's attorney argued that the president has absolute executive privilege. The court rejected that idea. And consistently since then, whenever the president has asserted an unreviewable power, the Supreme Court has rejected it. And the traditions, as well as the law, gives Congress the power of oversight of the executive branch. And for the first time, President Trump is arguing that Congress does not have that oversight.
Well, it's interesting you say for the first time President Trump said that he had this right, because we remember that Richard Nixon, after he resigned the presidency, told David Frost in that famous interview, you know, when he was asked about using the FBI and the CIA to investigate his political opponents, he said, well, when the president does something, that means it's not illegal. And I'm wondering, you know, most people do agree there should be a firewall between politics and the justice system. But for these people who don't, who believe in the unitary executive, this, you know, all-powerful presidency, isn't it in the president's favor, the history we just outlined? There's no Department of Justice in the Constitution. The first attorney general was a part-time job that, you know, some person did, you know, a few, push some papers around. It's evolved over time. Can't they say we're evolving it again?
Yeah, and I stand corrected. You're absolutely right about Nixon making that assertion. And I also mentioned that Bush asserted it as well. Yeah. Getting back to the question, it is a fact that the president is the chief law enforcement officer, in that it is Article 2 that delegates to the president the power faithfully to execute the law. However, our principle of separation of powers includes checks and balances. And that principle is as foundational as the idea that we have three branches of government. That's number one. Number two, there is such a thing as abuse of power, so that although the president has the power to enforce the laws, he does not have the power to enforce the laws in a way that are immoral, unethical, or indeed self-serving, as we see President Trump do today.
That's Professor Robert Kazurowski, law professor at Fordham University Law School. Professor, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.